Tim Thornton for Appellant Federal Insurance Company. The first thing I want to talk about is whether there was a potential for coverage and therefore a duty to defend. And our contention that the district court erred in its decision on this point. We believe that there was potential for coverage because we, in the insurance cases, distinguish between disparate impact cases and disparate treatment cases. And courts find coverage for disparate impact cases and not for disparate treatment cases because of the...
When I read the complaint, it looked like everything was on purpose, according to the complaint.
Well, that's the citation I handed up was for that point, because we view the complaint as very vague, as a very plain and short statement of the case, but not elaborating exactly what was going on. And so what happened
I'm having trouble finding the vagueness. I have the complaint here. It says that what they do is on purpose, they refuse to rent to non-Koreans at the multifamily residential rental properties. They refuse in the Koreatown section. They refuse to rent to African Americans in the Beverly Hills section. And what it lays down here is, according to the Justice Department, if they can prove it, that these people are just maintaining segregated housing on purpose.
And then let me just add to that the paragraph in the DOJ complaint that says the action was intentional, willful, and taken in disregard.
Right. So there's the intent to do the action versus intent to cause the harm would be one issue. But just to directly address that issue, they talk about the conduct constituting a refusal to rent, a refusal to negotiate for the rental, or conduct otherwise making unavailable or denying dwellings to persons because of race, national origin, and familial status. That comes from 3604A of the Fair Housing Act.
I think the structure of your argument, and educate me if I'm misunderstanding it, is that the Justice Department alleged in its complaint intentional wrongdoing, but they could as well have alleged in their complaint violation of the statute by a practice which unintentionally had a disparate impact, and therefore there's a potential for coverage for because it could be disparate impact and not intentional.
Yes, they could have proved their case either way. And so, for instance, this language...
There have to be either allegations in the complaint that fall within the coverage or true facts known to the insurer that fall within the coverage or facts reasonably likely to occur as known to the insurer that would fall within the coverage. And I don't understand where you get any of those required things.
It would have to be a neutral practice of some sort, and there was no allegations of a neutral practice. Were there facts that were known at the time to the other two insurance companies about a neutral practice?
Well, the other two companies were receiving communications from the insured. They received the complaint, and our position is the complaint is very vague. It uses this language, otherwise making unavailable, and the Texas Department of Housing decision last June, the Supreme Court said, took up the issue of whether the Fair Housing Act recognized a claim for disparate impact, which was a surprise since all the circuits had felt that that was the case, but they took up that issue. And what the court looked at is the Title VII uses this otherwise make unavailable language. The ADEA uses this otherwise make unavailable language. And the Fair Housing Act uses this otherwise make unavailable language. And that's where the court found that there was the possibility for a disparate impact theory to be allowed. And
But if you combine that with the facts that are laid out here, there doesn't seem to be any practice alleged and no adversely disproportionate impact. I had just trouble looking at the complaint and dividing that from anywhere. And you're saying all you have to do is put in the statute and that puts them on notice?
I think so. I mean, that
language... I don't think that's the law. I think the California Supreme Court, since the 60s, has been narrowing and narrowing so that it's not enough that the plaintiff might have claimed something different that would be within the coverage, either the plaintiff has to claim it or true facts known to the insurer must make it likely that the complaint will be amended to that effect.
Yes.
That would do. But there's nothing here like that. Now, sometimes what happens is in a year or two into the litigation, the discovery changes things, and it turns out that there are some facts that would justify a complaint that would be within the coverage, and then the plaintiff makes another tender of defense along with evidence of these new true facts, which then become known to the insured through the tender. But that never happened here.
There's nothing in the record to indicate that. That's
correct. So what you've got here is an insurance policy that covers negligently inflicted injury but not intentional assault and battery. The plaintiff pleads an intentional assault and battery and nothing else. The facts pleaded are the defendant walked up to me and punched me in the nose. No coverage. Now, sure. Under the defendant's liability insurance for that. And even though a plaintiff might have said the defendant negligently bumped me, he didn't say it and never did say it. And the true facts known to the insured are that that's not what happened. It was on purpose. And that looks like this case. And but that's why I'm having trouble understanding why your argument.
Well, that's the Delgado case you're describing, right? And so all of those cases like Delgado and the cases it cites in there like Kwan, those are all individuals under homeowners policies. They're not business entities. And in the complaint, it also alleges defendants and their agents and employees.
I don't think there's any doctrine in insurance law that distinguishes the business entities from the individuals in this respect.
Well, I think that, you know,
if anything, homeowners policies are usually construed more liberally.
I would agree with that. But there is a distinction between doing something yourself versus an agent or an employee doing it and you're being held liable for it, right? So that Federal versus Steadfast, the Court of Appeal found that there was potential coverage.
Well, that comes up in the child abuse and daycare centers all the time. But here, the complaint seems to say that Donald and Rochelle Sterling themselves did this themselves and through their agents.
But in, you know, paragraphs 10 and 12 and 13, they say, and their agents and employees.
Well, doesn't this argument now go to vicarious liability? Just to get back to the disparate impact question, which is no neutral practice is alleged. I think the Texas Department of Housing says a plaintiff at the pleading stage has to produce statistical evidence showing a causal effect from the neutral practice. So there's no neutral practice alleged here. So why doesn't the punch in the nose versus negligent bumping just say there isn't a disparate impact issue sufficiently raised by the complaint?
Well, I mean, I think the complaint really seems to follow the language of the statute, and it doesn't really say one way or the other whether it's disparate treatment or disparate impact. I mean, I think either of those are possible.
How would you characterize the neutral practice?
So later on in the case, you know, you could have things. There were claims made that putting the word Korean in the name of the building somehow indicated a preference for Korean Americans and therefore was discriminatory, or that posting notices to the tenants in Korean and without an English translation was, conduct that could have a disparate impact, could discriminate against the other tenants. There are things like that in there.
So that would be the neutral practice.
Those would be neutral practices, yes.
But posting the notices in Korean.
Yeah.
On that point, you indicated in the district court said you had alleged later that insurers knew facts that would have, in effect, put them on notice of potentially neutral practices. Are you making that argument now in the appeal as well?
We have the interrogatories, answers from the Department of Justice that are in the excerpt of record, but National Union contends they did not get them. I don't think Century Surety contends they did not get them.
Was there a tender? I mean, the way you would have new true facts known to the insurance companies is that there would be a a re-tender of the defense attaching the answers to interrogatories.
Yeah, we don't have that in the excerpt.
There is no such re-tender, is there?
No.
So are we, is it fair to say we're looking as a legal matter just at the DOJ complaint?
The DOJ complaint. There is correspondence in the fourth volume of the excerpt of record from defense counsel for the insured to the insurers talking about the case, what's going on, mentioning this related Sumner Davenport case, a woman who claimed she was terminated for not going along with these policies and that she had, the insured had obtained a jury verdict, a defense jury verdict in that case. Talking about the case being very vague, they had no idea what the government was talking about. So there is that as well that went to that letter is addressed to all the insurers.
I can't find the vagueness in the complaint. It seems like an unusually straightforward and clear one.
And also, yeah.
Let me ask you about paragraph 15 that was you've already been asked about it. Where it says, paragraph 15, the conduct of defendants as described herein was intentional, willful, and taken in disregard for the rights of others. That is about as clearly as you could say, and your insurance is not going to cover your wrongdoing. Now, what I'm wondering is, why would the government do that? Is there a different remedy when the conduct is intentional, willful, and taken in disregard of the rights of others, more damages or penalties or something like that?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, there is a provision for penalties when the government does bring an action, but I'm not aware that
allegation
makes a difference.
It doesn't matter if it's disparate impact or intentional, you get the same, the government gets the same remedy.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Often in ordinary civil litigation, people allege that something's negligent when everybody knows it's intentional so that the insurance will cover.
Sure. I mean, that happened in Delgado. That happened in many of the cases that have been discussed in the briefs.
But to here, it looks like what the government would like to do is punish the Sterlings, not their insurance company.
I don't know what they intended to do, but they pled the case, I think, just parroting the statute, frankly. And the statute allows both types of theories. And on top of that, you can have, negligent supervision type of claims. If you look at the proposed order that was sent with the letter from defense counsel to all the carriers, it talks about training. They want training for employees and agents. They want very clear procedures set down. So that's what the government's talking about. The other insurers had that information because it came in a letter from the defendant, a pre-suit letter from the DOJ to the defense attorney, and then that attorney to the carriers, talking about this is what they want, right? This is what they want by way of a consent decree. So they're talking about training and supervision. They're talking about clear procedures. So I think that you have that possibility, and that's what the Court of Appeal in Federal versus Steadfast found, that there's this potential claim for vicarious liability, that there are these potential claims for negligent training and supervision.
You only need vicarious liability when there's not direct liability, and this whole complaint sets out a case for direct liability.
I think it sets out, it could be read both ways, right? Because it does allege that the Sterlings did this, but it also does allege that agents and employees.
It said it did them themselves, and it also hired other people to do them.
Well, I think if the government pleads...
If your bus driver kills a passenger, the bus company may or may not have vicarious liability, depending on whether it's a superseding intervening act. But if the bus company has ordered the bus driver to kill or injure the passenger, that's direct liability.
I would agree with that, yes. But that's not what's alleged in the complaint.
Looks like it is. It says that they did it.
The defendants make a lot of the direction and control, but that's just the definition of agency. Your agents and employees are under your direction and control. Versus an independent contractor.
It says that Donald Sterling, Rochelle Sterling, and the Korean Land Company, which they owned, and the Sterling Family Trust, which they controlled, did this directly and through agents.
And through agents, okay. But they also allege that conduct in other places where the conduct was done by agents and employees. So I think that raises that possibility of vicarious liability. And that's what the Court of Appeal found in Federal versus Steadfast.
That would matter if the agents had done something that the Sterlings had not directed them to do.
And I think that's a possibility under the complaint, Your Honor. The complaint is very short. It's like 4 pages long. It doesn't give a lot of information. It just is basically laying out the elements under the statute.
So to the extent that the national union policy, I think they argue, employees, volunteers, others, real estate manager are all insureds. So would they be then, to the extent that they were doing intentional acts, would they then not be, would that then deprive federal of coverage? So if they're all insureds, regardless, under Minkler, it would be excluded from coverage if the acts were intentional.
I think under Minkler, you would look at that on a insured-by-insured basis. So if you have an employee that commits an intentional tort and you don't direct them to do it, like the bus driver example, if you don't direct the bus driver to do that, then he'll have coverage excluded because he intended it.
It said the mother could get coverage for her individual tort or negligent supervision.
Correct.
But that there was no expectation that she would have derivative liability from the son's liability.
Yeah, I think
because his act was intentional.
Correct.
So if these employees and agents are insured under the policy and their act was intentional, then to the extent you're claiming that there's a potential for vicarious liability, it would be derivative of an insured's intentional act. Wouldn't that exclude them from coverage then under Minkler?
No, I don't think it would. I think under Minkler, given the separation of insured provisions, you consider it on an insured by insured basis, whether that insured intended it versus they're just vicariously liable, or they're liable because of some negligence, like negligent supervision or training.
So if they were vicariously liable, that wouldn't be negligent supervision, right? That would just be derivative of the employee's liability.
That's correct.
That's the definition of vicarious liability, right? There's no... So your argument would be that there's alleged in this complaint negligent supervision.
Yes. Particularly, I think, when you look at the proposed consent decree that was sent in advance of the lawsuit, where they're talking about, we want these clear procedures, we want this training of your employees and agents. Yes, I think there was, Your Honor.
There's a public policy that underlies these definitions of occurrence and accident and intentional acts provisions in insurance policies.
Yes.
The public policy is that people should not be able to insure against their own intentional wrongdoing, even where insurance policies don't have that sort of clause. It's often been implied by the courts.
Sure. And we have a statute in California.
California is not a common law state in that sense, but
yes,
even in the common law states, it's usually been implied by the courts.
Yes.
Now, why wouldn't that apply likewise? Wouldn't there be a public policy against buying insurance for intentionally creating segregated housing?
Well, the way the decisions have come down is to apply something like that public policy to disparate treatment cases, but not to apply it to disparate impact cases.
I agree with you on that distinction.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
Yes.
But here, at least so far, and at least so far as the complaint says and any true facts known and tenders made to the insurance company, it's just plain intentional segregation, old-fashioned pre-1964 segregation is how it's pleaded.
You could read it that way, and I think you could read it the other way, that it's just vague and it doesn't say whether it's disparate treatment or disparate impact, or whether there's a mix of all those types of claims there.
You want to save some remaining time for rebuttal?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. I'm Rosemary Springer. I'm going to present argument on behalf of Appellee National Union. Counsel for Century and myself have divided our 20 minutes and equally in half, so I'll argue for National Union for 10. I'd like to start with an argument. There's two grounds on which this court could affirm the decision below. One is the decision the court made that there's nothing in the complaint that alleges anything other than intentional discrimination on the part of Sterling and its agents. The second ground is that it comes before you even get to the complaint, is that Beverly Hills Properties is not insured under coverage B of the National Union policy. Federal had the burden of proving, before you even get to whether there's coverage, whether there's an insured. The only named insured under coverage B is Near North. There's no language in the policy that says that members of Near North, which apparently Beverly Hills Properties is, are covered. Nothing. The policy has no language covering it. So for Federal to meet its burden, Federal relies on a document that's not part of the policy. It's called the bordereau. The policy can only be amended.
A bordereau isn't part of the policy?
No, it's not part of the policy, and it wasn't prepared by National Union. It was prepared by Near North.
Are we asking here whether there was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether Beverly Hills Property is insured? Is that that's the standard?
On summary judgment, that's the standard. And yeah. We were the moving party, but the non-moving party, Federal, has the ultimate burden of proof. So we would say our prima facie case was proven by showing the policy. There's no language in the policy identifying them.
So they say, look, it was purchased for a purchasing group, and then the purchasing group is listed on this document. Why isn't that enough to create a genuine issue of material fact that the intent of the parties to the insurance contract was not to give a purchasing group an independent insurance, but to insure all of the members of the purchasing group?
Right. So the policy can only be amended or modified or changed by an endorsement made by National Union. The bordereau is not issued by National Union, so it can't change the terms of the policy. But then if you go and look at what the bordereau says, say, well, does this raise a tribal issue about coverage B? The bordereau identifies Beverly Hills Property as a member of this purchasing group. We don't deny that. A purchasing group purchases insurance in general for its members. And the bordereau says that this member is insured under this policy number. We don't disagree with that. For a policy period that incepted on May 1st, 2000, we don't disagree with that. Coverage A of the policy, they're covered under that on that part of the policy. They're covered for $25 million for a policy period that incepted May 1st, 2000. They're covered because they're also covered on a $2 million primary policy issued by Chicago Title or Chicago Insurance Company. So the purchasing association did what it was supposed to do. It purchased insurance for a member for $25 million incepting on May 1st, 2000. That's what the policy language says. That's what the bordereau says. There's still no tribal issue that we intended or the policy was changed to also add them as an insured for coverage B. There's nothing that says that a purchasing organization has to purchase coverage for discrimination. They didn't.
It seems implausible that they might not have intended it. The challenge then is whether...
Can we rewrite the policy?
You would consider rewriting the policy. Others might consider it interpreting the policy or interpreting the scope of who is Near North. So I guess your position is it's not in there. Near North is Near North, end of story. Is that your position?
It's their burden. It's not in there. You're supposed to interpret the policy based on what it says, not based on after-the-fact arguments about what make more sense or what might be fair. I would use the example of a homeowner's insurance policy. They live on a fault, an earthquake zone. They get a policy that covers a bunch of things, but it excludes earthquake coverage. There's a giant earthquake. Everybody says, oh, my God, who would live on a fault and not purchase earthquake coverage, but the policy doesn't cover earthquakes.
Everybody in California.
That's a bad example.
Or half of the people in California.
But the court can't come in after the fact and go, well, that's not reasonable, that's not fair.
Where an earthquake endorsement is available but at a high price, many people choose not to buy it even though they knowingly live on a fault. But I don't really understand the bordereau. I guess I don't understand why there's an exclusion implied.
I don't think there's an exclusion implied, but okay, I don't think
it,
there's coverage
says
for
is,
coverage B implied.
It gives the policy number, which is right.
Right.
And all it says about the policy is Beverly Hills Properties - endorsement.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean, and why doesn't it cover the discrimination?
I don't know what that means. It's not, we didn't create that document. It's not a national union document, but...
Well, you're not limited to documents you create. The only advantage you get of not creating the document is the doctrine of interpreting it contra pro forentum does not apply.
The policy, the entire policy, it's called an umbrella policy. It has two parts, the excess coverage, coverage A, and the umbrella coverage, coverage B. The policy is called umbrella, though, so the bordereau seems to be referring to coverage under an umbrella policy, which would be the whole policy, but it only lists the policy term as beginning May 1st, 2000. The whole policy started in 1999, I think November 1999.
That just means that this bordereau didn't apply to the earlier time.
Or it means that it applies to coverage A.
Why aren't these just factual questions that, I mean, it seems like you've agreed that this bordereau indicates who's covered under coverage A, even though it's not referenced in the policy, I assume, and it's not a part of the policy. And so then the question is, well, does it also apply to coverage B? And then you're providing us with some factual arguments which seem more appropriate for a district court to decide in the first instance. How could we say as a matter of law it applies to A only and not B?
I'm not saying that it confirms they're covered under coverage A. I'm saying it's consistent with what we do concede, which the policy language says they're covered under coverage A. There's this other document that can't change the policy, and I'm saying, well, if you look at this other document, which is not part of the policy and is not endorsement to the policy, there's nothing on here that shows they're covered under coverage B.
There's some buried notion here that if you didn't write it and print it, it doesn't affect you, but it looks like it does. Just as a policyholder who didn't write or print the insurance policy is still bound and limited by its terms.
Well, the policy says it can only be changed by an endorsement. This is not an endorsement.
Well, the policy issue names who the insured is in endorsement one, and so the factual question, I think, is what does that mean that in California, at least, a court would be willing to consider parole evidence to determine whether the parties had in mind when they issued a policy to a purchasing group that, in fact, the insured were the members of the purchasing group, because that's the purpose of a purchasing group. So that's not changing the policy. That's interpreting the language of endorsement one, right? So the language of endorsement one, which identifies who the named insured is,
right,
says it's a purchasing group.
Right.
And so then the question is, well, does that mean that the insured are the members of the purchasing group, since that's the purpose of a purchasing group, is to purchase insurance together to cover their activities?
We agree that they're a member of the purchasing group. I guess our view is that the policy doesn't provide coverage under coverage B for members of the named insured. It only provides coverage for the named insured. Since I'm running out of time, though, I'd like to quickly address the main argument, which is the propriety of the trial court's decision that there's nothing in this complaint that alleges a potential claim for unintentional discrimination. Our policy only covers or covers discrimination, but then within the definition of discrimination, there's no coverage for discrimination by or at the direction of any insured. As was discussed in Federal's argument, this complaint is replete with allegations of intentional discrimination based on race or other protected status. And it's a pattern and practice. It's not random acts of discrimination. This is a policy, a pattern, and a practice set forth by Sterling. There's nothing in here that, as the trial court said, looking at this complaint, there are no allegations of unintentional conduct. There are no allegations of a neutral policy that played out wrong.
Could not a practice be a neutral policy?
Not if that practice, first of all, everything is intentional. That's what the complaint says, which is a required allegation for disparate treatment.
Understand. And then following the intentionality provision of the complaint, then there's another provision that talks about pattern or practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is there anything in that provision of the complaint that would foreclose the disparate impact? because you're talking about a practice, and it could be a neutral practice.
But there are no neutral practices alleged. The only practices that are alleged consistently throughout the complaint are treating non-Asians differently from Asians, for the most part. I think there's some other races involved, but treating people differently based on race intentionally. That's the theme. That's the overall theme of the complaint. It's clearly a disparate treatment theory. And there are no allegations of acting through agents either. Every allegation in that complaint says that Sterling and. That means in concert with, together with. There aren't allegations of agents running off and doing things on their own. They aren't part of Sterling's business.
If you were to prevail on the argument you're making now, that the complaint alleges only intentional acts which would be expressly excluded from the definition of your policy's coverage for discrimination, do you need the bordereau argument?
No.
Why don't we turn to your colleague for Century Insurance?
Thank you.
If you'll put 10 minutes on the clock for him.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Peer for Respondent Century Surety Company. Century concurs with Judge Klausner's rationale and with Federal's argument that there is no coverage for intentional discrimination, and this complaint alleges only intentional discrimination. What I would like to do is spend my few minutes talking about Century Surety's policy, which provides even narrower coverage for the claims in U.S. versus Sterling.
But before you get to that, maybe you're going to cover it, but I just would like to hear one of the other insurance companies talk about the impact of Steadfast and what that means in terms of your coverage.
Sure. In with respect to Century Surety, at least, it is completely different. Our policy covers only accidental discrimination. It clearly doesn't cover disparate impact discrimination. And there's California case law on point that because our policy is limited to discrimination caused by an occurrence, which is defined as an accident, that accidental discrimination is the key. And so the conduct that leads to the injury or the damage has to be accidental. Disparate impact doesn't satisfy that requirement, and there is case law on point. The Vista Medical Supply case, for instance, deals with that issue. And in Vista Medical Supply, it's an employment discrimination case. The insured argued, well, maybe there is disparate impact, and that would constitute the accident here. And the Vista Medical Supply Court said, no, that's not right. The act of setting an employment policy is intentional, and thus not an occurrence. Under a disparate impact theory, a plaintiff does not need to prove that the employer intended to discriminate, but the possibility that the employer may not have intended the harm does not create coverage under this policy.
So what kind of discrimination claims? Right? What kind of discrimination claims would be covered under your policy?
Accidental discrimination. Federal argues, well, that's illusory coverage.
Yeah, well, I'm asking you what? What does that mean?
my point was I went to the internet and just punched in accidental discrimination, and I got dozens of hits.
Well, usually it comes up with employment, doesn't it? Yeah. You have some sort of test, and no discrimination was intended, but one group does better than the other on the test.
Actually, or it
but
comes
those are,
up...
But those are often disparate impact. Those are disparate impact cases.
It comes up in the situation of advertising as well. A lot of the examples are advertising, where an advertisement goes out and white power toothpaste. People could take offense at that. There are literally dozens of situations like that, primarily in advertising. There's a swastika in a...
Do you have any less... dramatic examples? I'm trying to imagine one that would be plausible in the housing area.
Of accidental discrimination?
Mm-hmm. Disparate impact that isn't intentional in the area of housing.
I don't have one off the top of my head, Your Honor. It's an advertisement that goes out and misstates the requirements. You look on a billboard and it says, and actually there's an example right in the internet, it says Burlington Mall. Hold on, I wrote it down. Burlington Mall, blacks relocating to better serve you. Well, the point is it's a blacks store that is there, but the billboard said blacks, it's a situation of accidental discrimination.
It would be so a blacks apartment building would be an example?
Yeah, in this case it was black store.
Oh, you mean if the owner of the building is
named Black.
Mr. Black, Mr.
Jonathan
Black.
Right there, they show that. Say, people would take offense at this. There is a potential for accidental discrimination. It's narrow, and it's intentional.
So you're saying that it's not an illusory coverage?
It's not illusory coverage.
And is advertising covered?
Yes, advertising
is
covered. You okay. Bet. It's personal and advertising injury coverage. But the point here is that Century intentionally sold a narrower policy. In fact, the primary Century policy, which Federal concedes was exhausted through payment, is a completely affronting policy, meaning it's all the insured's money, both for defense and indemnity. Century got a $5,000 payment for writing the policy, but it's essentially all self-insured. That has the broader coverage. That has the same coverage that Federal and National Union have. Century chose to write narrower coverage, and the insured accepted that under the policy that included real Century money. And we said we will only provide discrimination coverage based on accident. And here there is clearly nothing accidental alleged in the complaint with respect to the charges against Sterling in the complaint. Moreover, any facially neutral policy, and there is none alleged in the complaint, would not satisfy the accident requirement. I wanted to point out a recent California case. It's a 2015 case on the negligent supervision issue. It came in after after all the briefing was filed here. It's the Albert versus Mid-Century Insurance Company, 2015, 236 Calip 4th, 1281.
And this is, you can give a copy of the citation to the clerk after the argument.
Okay.
I just say to counsel in general, that's why we have this little rule called 28J, so that we can get these, as we often do on Friday night, so we can at least look at them before the argument. So just for downstream suggestion.
I apologize.
Not a problem.
My mistake.
Not a problem.
I wanted to point out the facts in Albert are not uncommon. It's a tree trimming case. Not a discrimination case, tree trimming case. The allegation is that a neighbor hired an independent contractor to come in and prune trees, and the contractor comes in and he prunes not only trees on the owner's side, but prunes trees on the opposite, adjacent neighbor's side. Adjacent neighbor sues both the tree trimmer and sues the owner. And the company says there's no accident here because the tree trimmer clearly intended to trim the trees that were in fact trimmed, and the court agrees with that. That's in fact the case. So the insured says, well, what about negligent supervision? There is at least a hint that there was negligent supervision here, and negligent supervision would constitute an accident and therefore be covered. And the Albert Court had none of that. It said, first of all, the complaint doesn't allege any facts suggesting negligent supervision. And then it goes on to say, negligent supervision requires an employer supervising an employee who is incompetent or unfit. The employer had reason to believe that undue risk of harm would exist because of the employment of that unfit contractor, and harm occurs. There are simply no facts in the complaint or otherwise supporting the elements of the claim. My point is that if to the extent the Sterlings knew that their employees or agents were out discriminating against non-Koreans, African Americans, or whatever, there is no coverage for that. That's not an accident. And I think that's the point that the court is making here. Finally, with respect to vicarious liability, Your Honor, for vicarious liability to be covered under a policy like ours, or actually like any of these policies, the underlying claim has to be covered. That's even in Minkler. The Supreme Court makes that point when it talks about derivative liability. And it says essentially, if there's no in our case, discrimination by accident at all, named insured doesn't get coverage for that because it is somehow removed from the conduct. And the leading case on that in California is the directly on point, the Dyer versus Northbrook property and casualty, which is cited in our brief. That's an employment discrimination case, and it's right on point. A claimant alleges that he was wrongfully terminated and discriminated against. He sues the boss who fired him, and he sues the company. There's no coverage under the policy because it's a cause by accident policy as ours, and clearly the wrongful termination was an intentional act. The employer says, well, wait a minute. No, I'm vicariously liable. I didn't do the firing. And the court in Dyer says, no, that's not right. There is no coverage for that. The question isn't who's covered under the policy. The question is there any coverage for this intentional act for anybody under the policy? And the court answers no. Same is true here. If there's no accidental discrimination, which there isn't in this case, then nobody has coverage for it because that is what triggers coverage under the Century Surety policy.
Your time has expired. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Why don't you add another minute? He's got some time left, but we'll give you, we extended a little here, so we'll give you some additional time. So I'll give you a minute and a half.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I want to point out that both the National Union and Century Surety policies say we cover discrimination, but not committed intentionally by or on behalf, by or at the direction of the insured, or any insured in the case of National Union. And that formulation, I just want to point out, was the formulation of the exclusion in Gray versus Zurich that the court found to be hopelessly confusing and resulted in the duty to defend in that case. So that intentionally by or at the direction of is the formulation of the exclusion in Zurich, and that's the exclusion they've used, National Union and Century Surety have used in their policies. With regard to the named insured issue.
A lot of water over the dams in Zurich.
What's that?
A lot of water over the dams in Zurich.
Yes, there is. But I mean, you know, Delgado, which is fairly recent, talks about that fact and describes that exclusion as it discusses Gray versus Zurich. So it's still current law. With regard to the Dyer case, that was a wrongful termination case, and I think the point of what the court's saying there about vicarious liability is just that a company is not vicariously liable for the acts of its manager or supervisor terminating someone.
I just don't understand it. Suppose some old lady in a nursing home inherits an apartment building, and the managers manage it for her. She doesn't know anything about it, really, but it turns out her managers are discriminating. That strikes me as your vicarious liability type case.
That would certainly be.
But I don't understand it here.
Well, here, you know, there's talk about actions by them, but which would, you know, if it's direct discrimination by them, if it's disparate treatment by them, I agree that wouldn't be covered. But I don't think that that's the allegations foreclose disparate impact, and they certainly don't foreclose vicarious liability because they talk about acts of agents and employees, and they don't foreclose negligent failure to supervise or train because the draft consent decree specifically wanted training of all agents and employees. So I think those are issues in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank all the counsel for your argument this morning. Federal Insurance Company versus National Union and Century Surety is submitted, and we're adjourned for the morning.